The headlines this hour: three explosions rocked the Afghan capital, Kabul, causing multiple deaths and injuries. The cabinet of Pakistan's newly elected Prime Minister, Shahbaz Sharif, is sworn in days after lawmakers ousted Imran Khan from power. And Shanghai reports seven new COVID deaths as China's most populous city remains in a strict lockdown. Warm welcome to our studios here in the capital, Tehran. This is news. Thanks for joining us. Let's begin this hour with news from Afghanistan's capital, Kabul, where three huge explosions targeted an education center and a boys' school this morning, leaving a number of casualties.
People gathered to clear out the site after the blast. The second explosion happened in an alley. We heard an explosion and some people fell on the ground, while others ran away. Security forces arrived an hour later.
I was there when the first explosion hit. I carried as many people as I could on my motorbike and took them to the hospital.
The high school is located in a neighborhood that belongs to the Shia Hazara community in the western part of Kabul. Afghan media reporting that at least 27 people, most of them students, have lost their lives in the attack, while more than 20 others have been wounded. So far, there has been no claim of responsibility and no comments from the Taliban officials. Pakistan's new cabinet has been sworn in following weeks of political turmoil in the country. The swearing-in ceremony was held days after the parliament elected Shahbaz Sharif to succeed Imran Khan as prime minister. Earlier this month, lawmakers removed Imran Khan from power in a no-confidence vote. The motion was launched by the opposition, accusing the former premier of failing to revive the economy and crackdown on corruption. But Khan blamed the United States for his ouster, saying that Washington organized a conspiracy against them. China reports seven more coronavirus deaths in Shanghai, where authorities are combating the first major outbreak since the year 2020. The new deaths raise the city's total from the recent outbreak to 10. There have been hundreds of thousands of infections in Shanghai over the past few weeks. More than 20,000 new infections have been reported for Tuesday. Many of Shanghai's 25 million residents have been confined to their homes since March. China has also introduced lockdowns in other cities hit with less serious outbreaks of the Omicron variant. The French presidential election has roared back to relevance as voters are upset over the inflation crisis. Many are upset with the austerity policies of President Emmanuel Macron, although others are also skeptical of his contender Marine Le Pen's promises. Ramin Mazari has more from Paris.
The French presidential election was trending as an easy victory for the incumbent, Emmanuel Macron, until the unrest in Ukraine began. Macron's insistence on long-term sanctions for Russia exploded already high inflation. That's resulted in widespread hardship, resentment, and tough assessments of Macron's economic record.
It's clear that Macron has not improved the quality of life for the French. He's not responsible for all the problems he's had to deal with, but it's clear there's a big difference between what he's promised and what he's delivered.
The French election may come down to this. Who do voters feel will protect the average person from the economically explosive effect of long-term sanctions on Russia over the unrest in the Ukraine? It's not a question the mainstream media wants to discuss, but it is top of mind for the average person. Polls show the race is now a dead heat, with a soaring Marine Le Pen of the National Rally taking an opposite tack, promising to oppose Russia energy sanctions, which are wreaking havoc with gas, heating, and food prices. As the challenger, Le Pen doesn't have a record to defend, and she's escaping anger over the economic crisis.
Macron has absolutely not done a good job on protecting our purchasing power. The middle class feels that Macron has contempt for the middle class, and they also feel a great contempt for the neoliberal globalist banker Macron.
Macron's far-right economic policies provoked the unprecedented yellow vest protests in 2018. He only made minor concessions before turning to brutal repression and the coronavirus crisis only aggravated economic inequalities.
Macron needed to go much further in his efforts to reduce prices. It's unbearable to go to the supermarket these days. Even people who make an honest salary say that they are having trouble.
Abstention may reach record highs because many voters wonder if Le Pen would actually deliver on her populist economic promises. Her party has historically been aligned with neoliberalism as well. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
Russia says it has struck over 1,200 targets in Ukraine with missiles and artillery shells overnight. According to the Defense Ministry, its forces also downed a Ukrainian MiG-29 fighter jet in the eastern region of Donetsk. The ministry has also called on Ukrainian forces and foreign mercenaries to lay down their arms and leave a steel plant in Mariupol. Russian forces took over the southern port city on Saturday. Earlier, Ukrainian media reported explosions along the eastern front line, including in Donetsk and Kharkiv. Zelensky says Russia has begun a large-scale offensive along the eastern regions with a focus on Donbas. According to his office, shelling and fighting in frontline areas in the east have killed at least 30, wounding 30 others. The evacuation of civilians in eastern areas also remains halted for the third straight day. Sweden, in recent days, has seen violent protests over the burning of the Holy Quran by a far-right group. Those demonstrations have left dozens of people injured. We earlier discussed the reasons behind the protests and their future with our guests in our news review program. Let's take a listen.
Swedish police say days of unrest in the country, sparked by the burning of the Holy Quran by a far-right group, has left dozens injured. According to the police, 26 officers and 14 civilians are among those injured during the protests in several cities since Thursday. The unrest triggered by the far-right party that held a rally in a Muslim-dominated area and burnt a copy of the Holy Quran, which is well known for its anti-immigrant and anti-Islam stances, is intending to mobilize support ahead of the September elections. Its leader has been visiting cities and towns with large Muslim populations to divide the communities. Tensions continue to mount as there was another plan by the group to publicly burn copies of the Holy Quran. Police say those who commit violence are criminals with no links to the demonstrations. Now, to discuss that further, we are joined by Muzaffar Haidar, Creative Director at the Islamic Plus, joining us live from Qom, and also Sayyid Mohsin Abbas, journalist and political commentator from Islamabad. Sayyid Mohsin Abbas, all this is happening under the guise of freedom of expression. How is that possible? Blasphemy under the guise of freedom of expression? Doesn't that contradict being able to coexist?
Well, most of Europe is in a complete mess when it comes to talking about freedom of expression and religious rights and racism as well. There's a huge confusion which has been deliberately, I think, engineered because most of what we know as Islamophobia and most of what we know as racism is not an accident, and it's not just something that's come up from the grassroots. It's actually something which is systemic and very much engineered from the center of a lot of establishments, neoconservative, as well as actual formal governmental establishments. Now, to understand the phenomenon of Islamophobia and what's happening in Sweden, you have to have this context first. The reality is that these establishments have been manipulating the use of migration as an issue to whip up the fear amongst Europeans, the fear of being swamped, the fear of their jobs being taken up, the fear of economic, you know, woes coming in, and just generally the fear of Islam and the fear of a foreigner. This is something which is very, very commonplace and a very real sentiment at the grassroots level of Europeans. Now, that's been clearly manipulated by extra factors, and yet what happened, those factors include, for instance, the idea of creating more division in society and having class wars, gender wars, race wars, religious wars. This is all very much part of the Great Reset and the neoconservative plan to keep people occupied while they carry on and do the re-engineering of Europe in terms of its economics. So there's a very, very grand master plan involved. Racism is just one component of that. Islamophobia, whipping it up, is another. So the fact of the matter is that extremism, the role of counter-extremism, the idea of terrorism, this has also been a major factor in whipping up the fear amongst ordinary Europeans. So added to migration, add this business of terror, and you see that there's a very, very powerful cocktail of fear that it has been instilled. And most of that is then linked to Asian-looking, Muslim-sounding individuals. And that, coupled with the fact that the never-ending wars of terror of these same Western nations, which have inflicted pain, misery, and death in Muslim lands, and have, of course, then reaped the storm of migration, because, of course, if you go and displace people, destroy their homes, they're going to run. Where they're going to run to? Well, neighboring lands, but also many have come into the European territories. That's largely been accepted by, say, for instance, Germans. They've allowed a million or so Syrians in just in one wave, for example. But the repercussions of that are that far-right groups, like the hardline party here of Paludin, they get the opportunity to deliberately provoke Muslims more, start burning Qurans, whipping up more hatred. So what there is an environment of hate which is being supplemented by these geopolitical maneuvers, largely of Western neoconservative governments, which is all turning into a perfect storm for increased hatred of Muslims and for right-wing parties to rise.
Thank you, Mr. Said Masnavas. Back to our guest from Qom, Muzaffar Haider. In your opinion, why are these far-right groups gaining more ground, more political ground in those countries?
Yeah, and actually, just to go back to what Sayed Mohsin Abbas mentioned just a moment ago about people needing something to blame. I mean, to take a page out of the book of the Westerners, I mean, I was educated in the UK, and we were taught in high school, in secondary school, how when the German people were under a vast amount of pressure, economic pressures, and they were suffering from the reparations, they needed somebody to blame, and therefore they started to blame the Jews and the communists and the others. Societies generally need a scapegoat, and governments love that scapegoat. They love to give that scapegoat to the people in order to distract them from the main issues. And there's a really interesting point to be noted here, relevant to today's age, which is that, look, these same governments are now funding neo-Nazis in Ukraine, you know, and this is something that a lot of people do not want to look at or realize. It's the ironic reality of the world that we live in today. History is repeating itself in a spectacular fashion, and this time the scapegoat is Muslims. People want to blame somebody, and they're going to blame Muslims. And therefore, we see a huge rise in Islamophobia. And the states are not only not trying to suppress that and stop it, but they're actually encouraging it. And we saw in this whole thing with the Quran burning just now, that the police were actually facilitating for that heinous and vehement hate crime to take place.
Thank you very much, Sayed Mohsin Abbas, journalist and political commentator, live from Islamabad. Also with us, live from Qom, was Muzaffar Haider, creative director of Islamic Plus. Thank you very much to both of you gentlemen for sharing views with us on this edition of the News Review.
Italians have condemned the Israeli forces for raiding the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound in Al-Quds and attacking Palestinians who were inside praying. A growing number of Italians believe that Israel should be held accountable for the continued atrocities and violations against Palestinians and their holy sites.
Italians have slammed Israel's continued pursuit of repressive, violent practices against Palestinians following the killing of several Muslims, including a teenage boy, by Israeli security forces at the Al-Aqsa Mosque, a major holy site in Al-Quds, last week. Tensions between Israelis and Palestinians have been running high over the past weeks, with Israeli forces carrying out numerous raids in the West Bank, which led to the deaths of a number of Palestinians. The latest round of violence by Israel on Monday saw its soldiers forcing their way into the Al-Aqsa Mosque and removing worshippers from its courtyards in order to allow settlers to exclusively mark the Passover holiday into the compound.
Once again, during Ramadan, a new aggression against Palestinians by the Israeli regime. This time they caught off guard men, women and children who were praying at the Al-Aqsa Mosque. This again has shown the nature of the Israeli regime and the complacence of the international community.
Last year, during Ramadan, similar violence broke out, sparking the biggest conflict in years between Palestinian resistance movements and Israel, an 11-day war which only ended following intervention by international mediators. The violence against Palestinians at the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound in the occupied old city of Al-Quds came at a particularly sensitive time. Ramadan this year coincided with the Christian Holy Week, which ends today, Monday, the second day of Eastertide. Catholic faithful have strongly condemned the latest killing of Palestinians by Israeli security forces.
For the umpteenth time, it is a provocation by Israel. This action were just a fresh provocation. There is a lack of respect for others' beliefs. During Easter time and Ramadan, we have to be more thoughtful.
Tensions there are due exclusively to Israeli occupation policy. However, the international community seems to have lost interest in the conflict. By not taking any side, the Italian government is supporting Israel in practical terms.
Last meeting between Italian and Palestinian authorities took place in December when Palestinian Foreign Minister Riyad al-Maliki met his Italian counterpart Luigi Di Maio on the sidelines of the 7th edition of the Rome Med Dialogues Conference. Other than reiterating Italy's traditional support for the Palestinian Authority, Di Maio reaffirmed Italy's commitment to a just, sustainable and negotiated two-state solution between Palestine and Israel as the key to stability and prosperity in the enlarged Mediterranean. Max Civili, Rome.
Palestinians have held a funeral for a young girl who died of her injuries sustained during an Israeli attack in the occupied West Bank. 18-year-old Hanan Mahmoud Khadour was on her way home when she was injured by Israeli fire during a raid on the Jenin refugee camp a few days ago. A spokesman for Hamas has described the killing as a heinous crime, saying that the Zionist regime will not be able to undermine the Palestinians' struggle for their legitimate rights. The northern West Bank city of Jenin has lately become the scene of an armed resistance campaign. Since earlier this month, Israeli forces have been attacking the refugee camp in Jenin, as well as other cities in the West Bank. The raids have left a large number of Palestinians dead or wounded, escalating tensions across the occupied territories. And that does it for this edition of World News. Bye-bye for now.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Insight. Good evening and welcome to Insight. On this episode, we will be discussing Yemen in a conversation with Ibrahim Al-Daylami, Yemen's ambassador to Iran. But first, this brief analysis.
Yemen is an ancient civilization located strategically at the crossroads between east and west on the Bab al-Mandab, the naval choke point connecting the Indian Ocean to the Red Sea. Anyone wanting to travel by sea between Asia and East Africa and Europe has to pass by Yemen. This strategic location has made Yemen an object desire for empires old and new. In modern times, it was first the Ottomans which occupied the country, and then later, after the construction of the Suez Canal, connecting the Red Sea to the Mediterranean Sea, the British established a crown colony and a protectorate centered around the southern port city of Aden. The Aden Protectorate was one of the very last British colonies to gain its independence in 1967, following a bloody uprising by the local Yemeni population, and it is quite possible that the British would still be in Yemen today if not for the militant uprising by the Yemeni people, which expelled the British. During the Cold War, the country was divided between North and South Yemen, one allied with the Western Bloc and the other allied with the Eastern Bloc. After the collapse of the Soviet Union in 1990, and after a series of conflicts between the two Yemeni states, Yemen was reunified under the leadership of Ali Abdullah Saleh, who had been ruling the North since 1978, and this unified Yemen allowed the US to maintain a significant security presence in the country under the excuse of fighting terror. But in fact, it was because of the old need to control the Bab al-Mandab and to strategically deny it to anybody else, including the Yemeni people to whom this area belongs. At the same time, America's vassal, Saudi Arabia, was spending vast sums to establish Wahhabi and Takfiri-inspired schools and political parties in Yemen to change the delicate social balance between the Shia Zaydis and Ismailis on the one hand, and Sunnis who predominantly followed the Shafi'i school of law on the other hand, which had existed for centuries. After years of discrimination and provocations by the Saudi-backed Salafis and the assassination of the Zaydi leader Hussein al-Houthi, the Zaydis began an uprising against the Western-backed central government in 2004. This continued until 2011, which saw a general uprising in the country against the decades-old rule of Saleh as part of the wave of revolutionary uprisings in the Arab countries at that time. During the revolution, the Houthis liberated the capital Sana'a in 2014 and took over the government and the Western and Saudi-backed government now led by Saleh's former deputy, Abdrabu Mansour Hadi, who resigned and fled to Aden. This triggered a military invasion by Saudi Arabia and the Emirates, with air force, intelligence and logistics support by the US and the UK. Again, in the name of fighting terror, but actually in order to maintain control of the Bab al-Mandab and not to allow it to fall under the control of the Popular Revolutionary Government. Contrary to initial assessments by Western experts, the Saudis were decisively beaten by the Yemenis, and the Americans now gave the Emiratis the mission to secure southern Yemen, this time with the direct help by American special forces and American mercenary companies famous for committing war crimes in Iraq and Syria. These forces even began to attack the Saudi-backed Hadi forces in that region. Currently, there is an attempt to once again split Yemen in two, with the South being a Western puppet state nominally backed by the Emirates. Beyond the daily horror of the Yemen war, which even the usually lame United Nations has called the greatest humanitarian crisis of this century, the war in Yemen is ultimately being fought about two fundamental principles. First, the Yemeni people controlling their nation's sovereignty and its strategic choke point without the US and other powers interfering. Second, and more importantly, the attempt by the Yemeni people to establish a popular republic where the rulers are chosen by the people, which will then serve as a living model for the people living under Western-backed family dictatorships in the neighboring countries of Yemen, such as Saudi Arabia. Maybe this is the key to understanding the bloodthirsty behavior of the US and the UK, who continue to kill, maim, bomb, and starve millions of people in Yemen through their Saudi and Emirati proxies. The absolute need to prevent the idea and living model of a popular government backed by local populations being a replacement for Western-backed family dictatorships, and the daily dose of murder and mayhem required to implement this policy, has once again revealed the true evil nature of those Westerners who hypocritically claim and cynically advocate universal peace and human rights, but who engage in the absolute opposite when it comes to places such as Yemen.
Welcome to Insight. Tonight, we will be discussing Yemen with Yemen's ambassador in Iran, Mr. Ibrahim Al-Daylami. Welcome, Mr. Ambassador. Thank you for coming on to Insight. As you know, our program tries to look at the historic and strategic background of the news and the events that occur. And so with that in mind, I would like to talk about the Yemen and the war in Yemen and the events surrounding the crisis that exists in Yemen from that perspective, from a historic and a strategic perspective. And I would like to start maybe talking about the fact, the geography of Yemen, the fact that it is located in a strategically very important part of the world, Bab al-Mandab, the area that connects the East with the West, that connects the Indian Ocean and Asia with Europe and Africa. And we see that historically, the great powers, the imperialist powers throughout history have always tried to control Yemen, and particularly the south, Aden and the areas that are on the coast. And we see that this is happening again. We had the Ottomans for a period trying to control it. After the Ottomans, we had the British establishing a colony in Aden. During the Cold War, we saw that Yemen was divided between the south and the north. And of course, both sides of the Cold War, the Soviets and the Americans supporting different sides. So this idea that Yemen has to be split up, it has to be divided so that they can control it, is not a new thing in history. And recently we saw that after the revolution, the Americans again tried, through the Saudis and Mansour Hadi, to maintain that control. When that didn't work, when the Saudis were defeated and their Yemeni proxies were defeated, they switched to the Emirates, supporting the Emirates, and through the Emirates, again, reviving this idea of separating the south from Yemen, occupying Aden, occupying Socotra, the islands, even entering into the war in Marib. Again, we have the U.S., the Emirates, and then this idea of splitting the south away from Yemen in order to control Bab al-Mandab. My question is this. Does the revolutionary government, would the revolutionary government in any shape or form accept a splitting of Yemen, or is the territorial integrity of Yemen a non-negotiable issue?
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم في البداية أتوجه بالشكر الجزيل لحضرتكم على إتاحة
In the name of God, thank you very much for having me and giving me this opportunity. Other parts of the world who are connected to the aggressors on Yemen, a war that continues for 8 years. They want to loot Yemen. They want to divide this country, but not just to 2 states, but more small parts. That's what they really want at the moment, and that's because of the important location of Yemen. This country is near the Arabian Sea, Gulf of Aden, and the Horn of Africa. As you know, we have a long border with Saudi Arabia and Oman. From the very beginning of the war, the aggressors aimed at implementing the splitting of Yemen. But we, the revolutionary government, which was formed in 2014, we knew it from the beginning, all those aspects and their intentions. As a result, we knew that it is our responsibility to confront their aggressions and foil all their plans, and we are still resisting. It is a clear decision, as Mr. Abdul Malik al-Houthi stated many times, that this confrontation is our national responsibility and religious duty to stand against this aggression and dismantle any plans to separate the south from the north of Yemen. This resistance, in fact, needs political endeavors in order to continue and end the defeat of aggressors. As you know, one of the main goals of the Yemeni nation, beside ending the siege, is to push all the foreigners and their troops to leave Yemen. not only the Saudis and Emiratis, but the Americans and Zionists. We have to stop all these aggressions and attempts to interfere in Yemen's affairs. We have already told the world countries that these wars will not be limited to Yemen. As you know, and as you must have heard in the news, the enemy is targeting all countries in the region: Syria, Iraq, Lebanon, and of course Palestine. I mean in the West Bank and Gaza. We should not also forget what happened in Sudan in a couple of years ago, which is now divided into two countries. Libya is also facing the same fate. This must wake us up about the aim of the enemy, particularly the U.S. and its puppets, which are unfortunately some Arab countries in the region.
Well, it's very interesting, Mr. Ambassador. You pointed out that, in fact, you have a presence, a direct presence by the Americans, by the Zionists. Some have said even some British forces directly on the ground. Of course, it's done under the flag of somebody else. It's done in a form that's maybe not that apparent. But let's talk a little bit about what they've done. So one of the things they've done is they have occupied Socotra, which is a very important strategic island. And so with the flag of the Emirates, they come and they take it over. But immediately afterwards, you see American Marines, you see Israeli forces coming in. They're even bringing some tourists from Israel now and making some claims about, oh, we have this old historic connection with the Emirates. And, of course, the minute they saw that Aden might fall out of their hands with the Ansar Allah and the revolutionary government being able to take it over, they immediately started attacking the Hadi forces. So there was even fighting among themselves, those forces, one backed by the Saudis, one backed by the Emiratis. I want you to please explain for our viewers this fact. This is something which is not properly explained in other media, in Western media, that it's not simply about everybody against, for example, Ansar Allah, everybody against the revolutionary government. It's everybody against everybody. There is a scramble. There is a attempt. Everybody wants to bring in their own people and try to control Yemen. The only people that are the Yemeni people who are actually doing it is the revolutionary government. That is not somebody else's puppet who is trying to take over Yemen. If you could please explain that a little bit more in detail for our audience.
Before answering to this question, let me point to something very important. Prior to the revolution, there were American troops in Sana'a, the capital of Yemen. They were present there under the pretext of helping American diplomats in Sana'a. There were so many American troops there. The most significant thing that happened was sending the Americans out of the biggest military base in the Arabian Peninsula, which had been built by the Soviet at the time. That was the most significant achievement by the revolutionary government. There is an attempt to pretend that the crisis in Yemen is rooted in domestic and internal differences among the Yemenis themselves. The UN Security Council in 2016 intentionally, in a conspiracy with world powers, tried to convince the public opinion of the world that the crisis in Yemen is a Yemeni conflict. But the fact is that the crisis in Yemen comes from efforts of Saudi Arabia, UAE, and beyond them, the British and Americans and Zionists and some others. They are not defending Yemen. So I think this background gives an insight to the viewers that Yemen's enemies are trying to tell the world that this crisis is a domestic affair. But in fact, it is the Americans and the Brits which have caused all this chaos using their tools, that is Saudi Arabia and the UAE and other mercenaries. At the beginning, they claimed that they wanted to help, but now they're trying to topple down a legitimate government in Yemen. We know United Arab Emirates and its government. We know it is not an Arab country with colonial intentions, but at the same time, it has turned into a tool at the hands of colonial powers, the powers which want to have easy access to strategic gates such as Bab al-Mandab and the Red Sea for implementing big projects. The Zionist regime and the U.S. want that for their projects against North Korea, China, Russia, and the resistance movement, which is being led by the Islamic Republic of Iran. So I think this background gives us a very clear image about this conspiracy, which is beyond Yemen. They want to divide the region and split it into smaller pieces in order to bring new Daesh or ISIS in the area and in the world. At the beginning, it was very difficult for the Yemenis to prove this fact for the world. But currently, I think with this long duration of aggression, I think most of the Islamic Arab countries and Muslim nations have noticed this conspiracy and the roots of this conspiracy. This conspiracy is bigger than Yemen. We as Yemenis, we don't have any other option but resisting and moving forward until we bring full independence to all Yemen, not to just one small part of it. We will not pay attention to what is being said in the mainstream media about Ansarullah. They are spreading lies about Ansarullah. Ansarullah is not alone in its resistance against the aggressions. All the Yemeni nation are confronting this aggression. Everyone must know that this is our responsibility. Every Yemeni feels the same. Maybe Ansarullah was alone at the beginning, but not today. Since all the Yemeni people are facing the same situation, we as officials are holding this responsibility to move ahead and not to stop. We will continue the resistance as long as we send all aggressors out of Yemeni soil. We will expel them out of Yemen, and then the revolutionary government will form a national government in Yemen.
I want to first come to the issue of the relationship between the revolutionary government and the Islamic Republic, and then later, continuing in what you were mentioning, I want to talk about, you know, us thinking a little bit about how it's going to be after the war and the situation, inshallah, after the war. So let's first talk about the relationship between the revolutionary government and the Islamic Republic. As you know, the propaganda media in the West always portrays the situation where they say, oh, the revolutionary government is a puppet of Iran, is a proxy of Iran. It does whatever Iran says. And the interesting thing, the funny thing is that both the revolutionary government and the Islamic Republic say, no, that's not the case. So please clarify for us once and for all, what is the relationship between the Islamic Republic of Iran and the revolutionary government? Does the revolutionary government take its orders from the Islamic Republic, or is it a relationship that is between two friends, two brothers that are equal, and they not a relationship like you have, for example, with the Yemenis that are working with the Saudis or the Emiratis?
We know that the U.S. makes decisions for some Arab countries and for some EU countries and for some African countries and Latin Americans and some Asian countries. They have military presence in many areas. And of course, they claim the opposite and keep saying that they're not doing this and that. And now, in order to defeat the public opinion of the world, they are announcing that Iran is a colonial power and has colonial presence in Yemen. They use their media power for spreading their lies. But the fact is that the relationship between the Islamic Republic of Iran and the revolutionary government of Yemen is a brotherhood relationship, a friendly one between two Muslim nations and two Muslim governments. And I can say that the Islamic Republic of Iran is the only country which has stood against the aggressions of Saudi and American governments against Yemen from the first day. Iran has helped us since day one and shouted that the siege against Yemen must be ended immediately. This war must end, and Yemeni people should be allowed to make decisions for themselves. In addition, we're one of the countries which is standing against the Americans and Zionists. We're part of the resistance movement in confronting the American and Zionist plots. Of course, it is a price, and we are paying the price of this resistance. We have to work together with different countries, and at the top of them, the Islamic Republic of Iran. As I told you previously, the war is not on Yemen only. They don't want Yemen to become a powerful country in the region. They see it as a threat against Zionist and American projects. We don't forget this, and we will remember this all the time. We are there because many world powers and some regional countries are targeting the Islamic Republic of Iran and the resistance movement. So we need to join hands and be united, based on an Islamic aspect, not only from a national point of view. We must not be ashamed of that, rather be proud of that. So we must not surrender to this media and its psychological warfare led by the West. We are Muslims and sons of one nation. We all belong to one nation, and this is our slogan. It has been our slogan since day one. Nothing can stop us from resistance. Nothing can prevent us from being united and against these aggressions. When we look at the reports published by them about the Islamic Republic of Iran, it's full of baseless claims that Iran is interfering in Yemen's affairs, internal affairs. However, it is not true. The same holds true about Yemen. It is not imposing anything on the Islamic Republic of Iran and its internal affairs. We see that in other countries, such as in Syria as well, Iran is not interfering there by no means. They know it well, and they know the brotherhood among Muslim nations, but they keep spreading rumors and lies against the Islamic Republic of Iran and also Yemen.
Well, it's because they've never experienced this relationship. It's always been that we are the masters. We tell our puppets what to do. We'll give them money. And whenever it's necessary, we change this one for that one. So, you know, as they say, some people imagine everybody is like them. So they can't even imagine, the fact that you would have a nation, the Islamic Republic. Iran is a nation that rose up against its own dictator. The rule in Iran is based on the will of the people. We have elections. The people decided. The government in Iran doesn't exist because the Americans or the Russians or the Chinese are supporting it. And this is exactly what the Saudis, the Emiratis, and their Western backers, they fear this. They are scared of this, that this could be a model, that if the Saudi people, the people living in Saudi Arabia, the people living in Emirat, and it's interesting, you can't really talk about the Emirati people. There's very few Emiratis. Yes, maybe we can talk about Saudi Arabia being a people separate from their ruler. They're scared. They see this happening in a place like Yemen, which is unfortunately also, you know, maybe less wealthy, doesn't have all the money that they have, and they're scared that this could become a model for the other Arab countries, and that they might rise up against their dictators one day. So it's, I think, really, and if you think this is incorrect, please tell me so. I think a lot of it, besides the issue of strategic, Bab al-Mandab, all those things, I think a lot of it is just they have fear of having popular governments in the region. When you see a country like Yemen with that, you know, thousands of years of history, with that civilization, one of the centers of civilization in our part of the world, when they see that these people are going to establish their own government, they, of course, immediately are scared. Exactly what we saw happen in Bahrain, when the people in Bahrain, they didn't even want a republic. They said, please just change the prime minister after 41 years. They can't handle that people would have a government that comes from themselves. This is what they fear, maybe. And this is one of the motivations why they are keep trying to, you know, kill and destroy and continue the war. Because they fear that this model could be adopted by the Saudi and by the Emirati and by the other Arab peoples. Your insight on this issue, please.
لا أنا أتفق معك تماماً في هذه النقطة وفي غيرها من النقاط التي طرحتها.
I agree with you on this point and all other points. Yes, you are correct. But we have suffered many, many types of interferences from countries like Saudi Arabia and many others, as mentioned before, such as the Americans, the British, and in the past from the Soviet Union. In fact, all those hard times in the past is the main reason behind the current revolution in Yemen. We were under colonial powers of Saudis and Americans. which used to designate presidents and prime ministers in here, unfortunately, and even the ministers. They used to control the cultural aspects of Yemen, from some religious parties, takfiris, to political scenes, through some tribal leaders. They used to control the military as well. Even the curriculum at the schools was controlled by them. That was one of the main reasons for the September Revolution, to get rid of this American hegemony that came to our country under the Saudi and Emirati flags. And now, after the Yemeni Revolution and after all these achievements, they have become worried about Yemen being an example for other countries. So they started this war. They wanted to derail or destroy the Yemeni Revolution along with some other revolutions during the Arab Springs. Of course, the conflict is very complicated, and we know that the Americans, the Saudis, the British, the Zionists, and the Emiratis are behind it. They don't want Yemen to become an example to the world, but we are determined to do so. The Yemenis have tasted the meaning of freedom and sovereignty, but we as Yemenis and the resistance movement and the Islamic Republic of Iran, we are masters in this area, and we will not stop at the middle of this path. We have joined hands with the Islamic Republic of Iran, and we are brothers. If you look at the title of the revolution in Yemen, it says it is Yemeni, no east, no west. But when it comes to negotiations, we see Saudis and Emiratis at the other side of the table, unfortunately. So the Yemeni crisis has been revealed to be a 100% American project. Just pay attention to speeches of Mr. Biden and the Saudi statements. There is no Yemeni talking about Yemen outside Yemen. On the other hand, see if any Iranian official talks on behalf of Yemenis. Not at all. This is the difference. The Saudis trying to drag Iranians into negotiation in Iraq about Yemeni issue, but Iranians have been very clear on that, and they were very sincere and honest and have acted decisively on this issue. They keep saying that we are not agents of Yemen. We are not Yemeni nationals. We are not allowed to talk on behalf of Yemenis to solve your problems. Iran tells that if you have problems, go negotiate with Yemenis themselves directly and talk to them. So here we can tell who is the master and who is the slave. There is a saying that goes, it is very difficult to explain what is very clear. But some people do not want to accept that. It is very difficult to explain that sun has light while it has light. It is very clear. Yemen's crisis is crystal clear. But some are still blind or prefer to act blindly. It is a bad thing for them, not for us. They are stupid. Most of them are stupid. And they are trying to distort the fact and the reality about Yemen. It is unfortunate.
Thank you very much, Mr. Ambassador. And on that note, I want to thank you for joining us on Insight, where we discussed Yemen with the ambassador to Tehran, Mr. Ibrahim Al-Daylami. Thank you very much. What insight did we gain from our conversation with Ambassador Al-Daylami? First, as always in history, Yemen's location at the crossroads between East and West will draw the attention of global imperialists seeking to control global seaways. Second, the Yemeni people are attempting to establish a government backed by their own people that is independent of global imperialists. This challenges the existence of Western vassal family dictatorships in the Arab world and is the reason why the U.S. and its vassals in the region are engaging in a quasi-genocide campaign in Yemen involving war crimes, famine, and epidemics. We learned that any people with a minimum amount of dignity will defend themselves if attacked and invaded, something that seems to be considered a virtue by Westerners if it's done by blonde, blue-eyed people in Eastern Europe, but is considered terrorism if done by the Yemeni people. We learned that Yemen's territorial integrity is a red line that the revolutionary government will not accept
any peace agreement that would involve the splitting of the country in two. And finally, we came to understand that the relationship between the revolutionary government in Yemen and the Islamic Republic of Iran is a brotherly relationship, something inconceivable to Western elites and various local sheikhs who are used to buying and exploiting proxies and then discarding them when they are no longer needed. Thank you for joining us on this episode. Until the next time on Insight.
Fiqh or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked among
the Holy Prophet of Islam is the example
of
self-purification is the most significant
factor.
Imamat is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism.
This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful, welcome to another episode of Ulama's Speech in this holy month of Ramadan. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Ali. Stay tuned.
سال میتونه آدم خوبی باشه، تو کل سال میتونه پاک باشه، اما فضای ماه رمضان یه فضایی است که خیلی راحت تر میشه خوب بود.
A person can be pure and righteous during the year. However, in the month of Ramadan, this chance is given to us more than any other time of the year. Consider a house which is many rooms and parts, for instance, living room, dining room, kitchen, etc. In any part of them, we can wash. However, the special place for washing is bathroom. In other words, washing and cleaning oneself is much easier in the bathroom compared to other parts of the house.
کل سال آدم میتونه پاک باشه، خوب باشه. اما این یه ماه.
Now, during a year, we can be pure and righteous. However, the holy month of Ramadan is like the washing place that helps you to be clean much easier. All the facilities are provided for us in the month of Ramadan to cleanse our souls. Of course, this does not mean to sit still and do nothing. A kind of motion is needed in the holy month of Ramadan. If you start purification of the soul during the month of Ramadan, then through action and practice, you can continue it during all other months of the year. Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of Ulama's Speech in this holy month of Ramadan, which was the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Ali. To find out more about this program, log on to our website, www.parstoday.com, Call of Islam page. We'll leave you in Allah's care and goodbye.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.